The countdown has begun. From May 14th to 16th, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections, gain unique insights, and uncover valuable opportunities in one of the world's most rapidly rising regions. Request your invite for this exclusive event at QatarEconomicForum.com.
Over the past few months, you've probably heard a lot about the Tuskegee experiment. In the 1930s, researchers began a study of 600 black men with syphilis. Scientists told them they were being treated for, quote, bad blood. That was not the truth. They wanted to study what would happen if syphilis went untreated. The study ran for 40 years. The men never received the proper treatment to cure their illness. Or you might also know the story of Henrietta Lacks, a black woman who underwent cancer treatment in the 1950s in a segregated hospital. She died, but researchers cloned her cancer cells. These cells became the first immortalized human cell line and led to countless medical breakthroughs. But Lacks did not consent to this. And while drug manufacturers profit off of them, her family had no idea and continued to live in poverty for decades. Or maybe you've heard about J. Marion Sims, the so-called father of modern gynecology. He experimented on enslaved black women without anesthesia. There was a statue of him in Central Park until 2018. Over the past year, these events have become a sort of shorthand for why some black people don't trust the COVID vaccines. And of course, this legacy of abuse is part of the reason for that mistrust.
You come to this point in life and you still have some of that trauma that you've held onto the residue from the oral stories that have been passed down generationally to your own experiences.
That's Dr. Timothy Sloan. He's the head pastor at the Luke, a Baptist church in Humble, Texas.
Now when you talk about the vaccine, there's the reminder of the trauma that was experienced through the Tuskegee experiment. And you hear the conversations that we need more African Americans to be tested to get more data for the vaccine, then that automatically triggers some mistrust.
But high-profile abuses, like the Tuskegee experiment, don't fully explain why the black community is so suspicious of the medical establishment. Dr. Sloan says there's a lot more to it.
So when we talk about the mistrust, I'm a descendant from the family of Briggs. Briggs versus Elliott was the first case tried dealing with school desegregation in Sumner, South Carolina in 1952.
Briggs versus Elliott was the precursor to Brown versus Board of Education, the landmark case in which the Supreme Court ruled that segregating schools was unconstitutional.
The case was tried in Charleston, South Carolina, not far from my grandmother's house. Thurgood Marshall tried the case. And so, of course, we didn't win that case. That's when they went on, though, toward Brown versus Board of Education.
The case was eventually appealed and then combined with Brown versus Board of Education. Brown would succeed where Briggs had originally failed and pave the way for Dr. Sloan to be the first person in his family to go to a desegregated school. Then Dr. Sloan told me about another piece of his family history.
My grandfather was murdered in Charleston, South Carolina by a white mob, and he was drowned there off the seashore.
Dr. Sloan says that his grandmother got a knock on the door, and someone said her husband had drowned without giving a reason why or explaining how it had happened.
They just said he drowned, but everyone in this town knew what happened, saw it happen there that night.
Dr. Sloan's family history isn't a diversion. It's the point. If you are Black in America, there are just more reasons to be on the defensive. Your school may not want you to get an education. Your doctors might want to use you as a lab rat. And one day, your loved one just might disappear without any explanation. How could you not be suspicious of all of the systems and forces that influence your life?
Those stories that trickle down, they come with a sense of guards up type mentality in your way of life.
I've talked before in this series about how vaccines require trust in order to work. Right now, the medical establishment is asking the Black community to trust them. And that's a big ask. Medical racism isn't just a historical fact. It's a present-day reality. Black women are 3 times more likely than white women to die because of pregnancy. Half of the number of Black people receive mental health services. Black Americans have the highest mortality rate for cancer compared to every other racial group. In this episode, I've made the choice to talk mainly about the Black community. Every community's relationship to healthcare and vaccines is different, and we could probably spend an entire episode on each of them. Polling has also shown significant hesitancy among Hispanic people and people who live in rural areas. Republicans are far more likely than Democrats to say they won't get the vaccine at all. Of course, every individual has their own experience too. No community is a monolith. But Black Americans have died at twice the rate of white Americans from the virus. So while there may be trust issues with the vaccine in communities of color, they're also the communities that need vaccines the most. The medical establishment's need to earn back some of that trust is a matter of life and death. And if they succeed, it could offer crucial insights into how to get other skeptical groups to get the shot as well. I'm Bloomberg News health reporter Kristen B. Brown. From the Prognosis podcast, this is Doubt.
The countdown has begun. From May 14th to 16th, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections, gain unique insights, and uncover valuable opportunities in one of the world's most rapidly rising regions. Request your invite for this exclusive event at QatarEconomicForum.com.
On September 12, 1900, Reverend R.F. Skinner founded the St. Luke Missionary Baptist Church in Humble, Texas. Humble is located 18 miles northeast of Houston, where the woody Big Thicket meets the coastal plains. At the turn of the 20th century, it was a small town along a rail line where most residents worked in agriculture or lumber. Eventually, oil would be discovered there, and the town would boom and bust many times over. Its residents were both Black and white, but they didn't really mix. The Black people of Humble were not allowed to attend white churches. St. Luke was a Black church. But in 1929, the story goes, the white residents held a meeting. They decided the Black churches of Humble were no longer welcome.
They told us the next day that there was a vote and we had to move our church. And we had to, if we would hurry, we could get some land on the other side of the railroad tracks.
As Dr. Sloan tells it, the congregation of St. Luke was asked to move literally across the tracks and landed eventually in an area called Bordersville.
And we were there up until the 2010 when we bought property and moved back into really the center of Humble.
For 80 years, St. Luke had been cast out of the center of town. Dr. Sloan came aboard in 2002. Under his leadership, the church bought 20 acres of land in Prime Humble, built a brand new multi-million dollar worship center that could hold 1,000 people, and eventually rechristened itself the Luke. This story is central to the church's mythology. The ending is a story of triumph, but it's also yet another story about people of color being cast aside and treated inequitably. These issues are baked into the identity of the church.
And a lot of what we do centers on the challenges and struggles that impact African Americans.
And for the last year, those struggles have included whether or not to trust in the COVID vaccines. As a pastor, Dr. Sloan is the leader of his 5,000-member congregation. He's a trusted voice. Throughout the pandemic, he had avoided discussing the vaccine in his sermons. Dr. Sloan himself was torn over getting one.
I had really been struggling with it. You know, I'd been talking about it, trying to figure out if I trust the vaccine, conversations with my wife.
His wife, the first lady of the church, is an orthopedic surgeon.
You know, we both were wrestling with it. And I started to think, though, wait a minute, if I have these questions and I've got access to the information I have access to, then surely the typical member in my congregation has the same questions. Then how are we all going to deal with this? And I think one of the big gaps is information in communities.
So the church did a survey and found that the congregation was pretty hesitant. In October, only 35% of congregants were comfortable getting vaccinated. And there was a lot of misinformation floating around.
You heard everything from people saying, you know, they're going to put a microchip in you to you're going to grow an extra limb, and I hear people are going to get cancer from this. You know, all kinds of things that were out there floating from what you see on social media. And I began just reading through all that stuff and was thinking, man, this is just bad information. And our biggest hurdle is information here.
Dr. Sloan's congregation isn't alone in its hesitancy. Different polls paint somewhat varying pictures of vaccine skepticism among Black Americans, but many suggest there is more concern about COVID vaccines among Black people than white people. A recent Kaiser Family Foundation poll, for example, found that 24% of Black adults say they plan to wait to get the vaccine until more people have taken it, compared to 16% of white adults. Those numbers are actually a lot better than when the vaccines first began rolling out. All of this skepticism presented a problem for Dr. Sloan. It's not enough to just give people the facts. Anyone can pull up government statistics, but in an age where everyone seems to be hawking a different set of facts, it's not just the message that matters. It's also the messenger.
And you're going to edit all this, right?
Yes. I have a producer. He will make you sound lovely and me sound lovely and put me in there and everything.
You tell him. I don't want him to make me sound like James Earl Jones, all right?
This is Dr. Stephen Thomas.
I'm a professor in the Department of Health Policy and Management at the University of Maryland School of Public Health.
Stephen has been interested in healthcare since he was a kid. His mom was a nurse.
And back in the day when nurses kind of looked like nurses, you know, the white starched hat, I remember her as a child polishing those shoes. And so that inspired me to be involved in health.
Stephen has been researching the issue of inequity in healthcare since before there was widespread acknowledgement that that was even a thing. He wants to understand the context that shapes the attitudes and behaviors of people of color when it comes to their health. He says there are a lot of things about how we talk about vaccines that don't inspire trust. This includes the language we use to talk about them. It can be scary, confusing, and sometimes also kind of offensive.
So you want to come into my community talking about herd immunity? Well, I can remember my grandmother telling me that at one time, white people thought of us like animals, like herds, like chattel. Why do you want to come into my community with that?
Stephen says that when you're talking about vaccination, you can't divorce it from all of the other healthcare inequities that can impact people of color. There are hundreds of studies that have demonstrated people of color routinely get access to worse healthcare in America. Black people are more likely to delay care because of cost. They're more likely to have diabetes, and they're more likely to die of heart disease. We've seen similar disparities play out with vaccination. Black and brown communities have been hit hardest by the pandemic. And yet, not every region has chosen to give communities of color more doses of the vaccine. Kaiser Family Foundation data shows Black and Hispanic people have consistently received fewer vaccines compared to their share of cases and deaths. And when inoculation sites have been set up to give underserved or minority populations better access to shots, sometimes wealthier suburbanites have just driven over to get shots there themselves. This is really frustrating for people like Stephen. It's clear that there is a concerted effort to make an overture to the Black community. When they announced the phase 3 clinical trials for the Moderna vaccine, the National Institutes of Health put out a Q&A, which featured a Black trial participant, talking about why it was important for Black people to take part in the trial.
I had questions that about what it would be like, about how it would impact on me. And so I'm here today to help others decide whether or not they want to volunteer to participate in clinical trials. I have to say that
the mayor of Tuskegee, Alabama, televised getting his own COVID shot. So did Kamala Harris, our first Black, Asian, and female VP. But lack of access, it just reinforces existing mistrust. And that doesn't just mean having shots available. It also means making sure everyone is able to figure out how to sign up for an appointment.
Don't put systems in place that you say are, okay, well, everybody can get online and sign up. But I know a whole bunch of people who look like me who don't have stable internet, still on flip phones, and can't sit around refreshing. You get me? So these built-in inequalities really exacerbate the institutional racism we've been living with.
Over and over again in reporting this series, I've heard from people that they feel dismissed or that their concerns about vaccines weren't taken seriously. That's a big problem across the board. It's hard to trust anyone who treats you like you're stupid or your concerns don't matter. Inequities make all of this worse.
Hesitant doesn't mean no. It means let's talk and don't rush over me.
This moment is a critical one. And there are forces conspiring to really try and screw it up. Anti-vaccine figureheads like Robert F. Kennedy Jr. have been targeting the Black community. In March, Kennedy put out a documentary called Medical Racism, clearly aimed at recruiting more people of color to the cause. But honestly, a botched rollout of the vaccines in which the people who need them the most can't get them, that stands to threaten the trust of the Black community as much as anything else. It's hard to trust a system that doesn't seem to prioritize or care about people that look like you. Those inequality issues desperately need to be addressed better. But efforts to gain the trust of the Black community do seem to be making an impact. And those efforts just might tell us something useful about how to inspire trust in vaccines in other communities. Stephen says we know plenty about why people of color distrust healthcare systems. He says what we need now are solutions. The idea for one of those solutions came to him over 20 years ago when he was getting a haircut.
I'll change his name to protect him, all right? Joe walks in. And you have to understand, in a black barbershop, you have TVs on every wall, all to a different channel. And the music's playing. And everybody's talking. So Joe comes in. Hey, Joe, where you been? He said he was in the emergency room. He pulls out these pills. He says, the doctor told me I'm going to have to take these pills the rest of my life. And the barber said, Joe, you know, if you take those pills, you won't be able to keep up your obligations. And everybody heard that. Now, do I have to explain to you what that means? Obligations?
I'm going to assume you know what he means when he says obligations.
I looked at Joe's face. He's not going to take those pills. His doctor has no idea there's somebody in the community with this level of influence. Now, Joe's been in the hospital, ER, you just count up the cross. Diagnosed, prescribed a medication, got the prescription filled, walks into a barbershop and not going to take those pills anymore. And may not want to go back to the doctor because he hasn't been following the doctor's orders.
This got Stephen thinking. It's easy to avoid the doctors, but not so much a barber. Not if you want to look good anyway.
No self-respecting black barber would ever say, I'll get you in and out in 15 minutes, okay? There ain't no super cuts, no hair cutlery, ain't none of that. You're going to spend half a day in the barbershop just catching up on things. Some people come in and they don't even need a haircut. So in many ways, it's a sacred space.
And this put an idea in Stephen's mind.
What if the barber was a partner? What if the barber said, hey, Joe, you know, if you're having side effects, you know, erectile dysfunction, don't be ashamed. Tell your doctor. He can change the medication.
In other words, Stephen wanted the barber and the doctors to team up. He wondered what would happen if health advice wasn't only coming from doctors, but also from a trusted member of the community. So in 2001, Stephen started what would become HARE, the Health Advocates in Reach and Research campaign. Through HARE, he trains local barbers and beauticians in Maryland to offer good health advice to the community and advocate for things like colorectal screenings. During the pandemic, Stephen has mobilized this network to disseminate accurate COVID information, including about the vaccines. Stephen believes that in order to get past the mistrust, you have to do the work to build trust. And that requires meeting people where they are. It requires listening to them. And it requires acknowledging the missteps of the past and the inequalities that persist today.
I don't like to have to throw Tuskegee in your face in order for you to understand that Black lives matter. And they don't have to be marching in the street to matter. They may be in a hospital. That matters too. With that one word, think of what I'm saying to you. That these institutions have a history of abuse in the name of, I'm here to help you, in the name of science. Now you want me to trust this science? This is a legitimate distrust. And our effort should be then to rebuild trust and then and be trustworthy.
At the end of the day, even your favorite celebrity probably isn't as convincing as someone you know, like your aunt or your barber or your reverend.
Thank you. Collaborate for a greener future at the Bloomberg Green Festival, a groundbreaking celebration of the thinkers, doers, and innovators leading the way. From design and culture to technology, science, and entertainment. Hear from inspirational speakers and immerse yourself in climate solutions, July 10th through 13th in Seattle. Title sponsor, Amazon. Official airline, Alaska Airlines. Get 20% off using promo code RADIO20 at BloombergLive.com/Green Festival.
Back in Humble, Texas, Dr. Sloan was struggling with what message to send his congregation about the vaccine. The pastor still had a lot of questions by the time vaccines were starting to roll out. He began thinking about what kind of trusted expert the church could turn to for answers.
I thought to myself, why not ask the top doc in the nation? And, you know, the worst he can say is no. And, you know, if he doesn't respond, nobody knows I sent the letter but me.
So he sent an email to the office of Anthony Fauci, the head of the National Institutes of Allergies and Infectious Diseases. A week later, Dr. Sloan got a response. Fauci was in. On January 6th, the same day that pro-Trump extremists stormed the Capitol, they taped an interview. It would air that Sunday as part of the day's worship service. Dr. Sloan says that going into that interview, he was still feeling pretty conflicted about the shot. But there was one moment in which he started to change his mind.
First of all, I think we need to acknowledge that the concern and the hesitation based on what you refer to as, you know, the slights and the mistreatment of the African-American community historically by the established government medical establishment is real in history. And we have to recognize that it occurred, and we have to emphasize that situations have been put in place, safeguards have been put in place that this could never happen again.
When he did that, I felt like for the thousands of people who were watching, guards automatically went down. And there was a receptiveness towards what he was saying. And after listening to him, after hearing the thoroughness, after hearing the different things explained in layman's terms, I concluded that conversation with confidence in taking the vaccine.
This goes back to a lot of what we talked about earlier. People, and especially Black people who have been screwed over time and time again, want to be acknowledged and heard. Fauci was putting all of this into practice.
And I think that's what many people want. They want to know that what I feel is legitimate. And he legitimized a lot of the pain and trauma of African Americans. And so we were like, okay, all right. So here's someone who really understands where we're coming from. And I felt that way. Okay, you understand where I'm coming from with these questions.
So the interview plays as part of the Sunday service. After it ends, it's time for Dr. Sloan to give his sermon. Dr. Sloan says that initially, he felt uneasy telling his congregation to go and get vaccinated outright, even though his own concerns had dissipated. This is something I've heard from other leaders of Black churches in reporting this. A lot of them say that they want to give their congregants good information about the vaccines, but they don't want to go so far as to tell them they should get it. Many have told me that would risk compromising the trust their congregations have in them. They don't want to appear as if they're on the side of corporations or the government instead of their community.
I wanted to offer to people, you know, hey, take this information, make the best decision.
So the Reverend takes the stage after the interview plays. He's wearing a crisp black suit and light pink tie. He has thick black framed glasses on. He starts with a story about lepers.
In the book of 2 Kings, chapter 7, beginning at verse 3, the word of God is recorded.
The story goes that there were four lepers standing outside a city gate. The city is suffering from famine, and the lepers are trying to figure out what to do with themselves.
So they said to each other, "Why should we stay here until we die? If we say we'll go into the city, well, the famine is there and we will die. And if we stay here, we will die. So let's go over into the camp of the Arameans and surrender."
Dr. Sloan then goes on to say that he's telling this story because it's about people making decisions together. And then suddenly he switches gears from the Old Testament to today.
I don't need to tell you how startling the statistics are. To date, there have been over 90.1 million cases of COVID worldwide, 1.93 million deaths, 22.7 million cases, and 381,000 deaths in the United States alone. And those numbers are still rising as we speak. And while these numbers are alarming, they're even worse for African Americans.
As his sermon unfolds, he discusses Tuskegee and why it's understandable for Black people to be suspicious of the vaccine. And then he makes a link between the lepers and the Black community.
Challenges are nothing new to us, but we've always been reminded that overcoming obstacles is going to require an undaunted faith in God. And that's why we can so easily identify with these lepers in this text. We share similar realities. We know what it's like to be ostracized because of your skin color. We also know what it's like to be written off by others, but used by God.
He again lays out the options the lepers had. Go into the city and die, stay at the gate and die, or go to the camp and possibly live. At this point, he does something he wasn't planning on. He takes a stand on the vaccine.
"We try to go back to normal without the vaccine, handcuffed by the traumatic past that's been inflicted upon us, we'll die. If we stay here and just hope things will get better and it'll magically disappear, then we'll die. But if we take the vaccine, we live."
Dr. Sloan's plans had changed mid-sermon. It wasn't enough for him to tell his congregation to just try and find the best information about vaccines. He had decided to trust, and he wanted his congregation to do the same.
"And so I get home and my wife goes, 'So I guess you just told everybody to take the vaccine, huh?' And then I said, 'Well, I guess I did, you know?' And I think that is what I really did want to accomplish. I wanted to let them know how much confidence I have in it. And I think it's pivotal for us."
Dr. Sloan went even further. In February, he put out a video that was basically a PSA for vaccination. Fauci's message to the community was important, but it carried even more weight when endorsed by a trusted church leader. There's evidence that efforts like this are paying off in the Black community. A lot of faith leaders have spoken out.
"If pastors and faith leaders just simply continue to waffle about it and not choose one side or the other, then you're going to leave still a lot of people out there who are still sifting through the information with maybe some difficulty in actually really comprehending it and never really making, you know, a proper decision. So I felt like I need to tell you where I stand and what I think is important for us. But just like my sermons, you know, every Sunday, pre-vaccine, you know, listen, you can take it or leave it. Some of you might not like it, but here it is. This is what I believe."
Dr. Sloan has heard from his congregants that Fauci's talk really made a difference for them. I spoke to one of them, Letty Coverson, a retired teacher in her 60s who was also a deacon at the Luke.
"One day I would say, 'I'm going to take it.' And the next day I would say, 'No.' I wouldn't think about it for a while. I'd say, 'Well, I'm going to take it. I'm going to take it.'"
The pandemic has been rough for Letty. She feels lonely often and isolated. She wants to hug her grandkids and also to stop having to explain to them why they can't hug. But as much as Letty wants the pandemic to be over, she also had lots of concerns about the vaccine. Letty says she first started to really question whether she wanted to get the shot once vaccines were rolling out.
I started thinking about it when it became a reality that it was going to happen. That's when I started thinking about it. But it was also that in the back of my head, why so fast? How can this be done so fast? And I began to think about in the back of my head, the health inequities, all the things that go along with me being a Black female and the history of that.
Letty actually had a health scare herself when she was 10. She had the measles, but white doctors couldn't figure out what was wrong with her and wanted to perform exploratory surgery.
I can remember their words today, and they said, if you take her from this hospital, she will die. But my mom said, no, I'm taking her for a second opinion. And she did. And the doctor who gave us the second opinion said straight up, if they had operated on her, they would have killed her.
In the end, it turned out she didn't need surgery. She just needed a few days to recover. The doctors had almost opened her up for no reason. Letty had been put in danger by doctors in the past. So now, she wondered, why trust them?
Remembering that experience that I had when I was 10, that's still there.
So she just kept going back and forth, deciding to take it and then deciding not to. And then she heard the Sunday sermon with Fauci. Like Dr. Sloan, it really stood out to her that he recognized what the Black community has been through.
And he talked about our medical issues that are generational, some of them, diabetes, blood pressure, heart. And it's because of the inequities, and it's also because of the jobs that we have. And I want people to really understand and hone in on why. Why it is happening to us more often, and it's not our fault. It is not our fault.
So, Letty got vaccinated. She's had both her shots. And she says she felt a little fear before she did it, but she did it anyway. And then she went home and told her family about it, many of whom had also been hesitant to take the vaccine. One of her sons actually went to Tuskegee University for college, and she told me he was afraid of going to the clinic there. The syphilis study loomed over it.
And after I got my vaccine, my son that went to Tuskegee got his. My husband got his. My daughter's going to get hers soon. My oldest son and his wife had COVID, so they have to wait. But they're good. They're going to take the vaccine.
This gets at what Stephen Thomas was talking about. Even if your barber isn't an MD, you might trust his advice more than your doctor. Or in this case, you might trust your mom, who trusted her reverend, who in turn decided to trust a healthcare official who took the time to listen and address community concerns. A lot of work went into convincing Letty to get vaccinated, but it paid off. She even blogged about it.
I want to say I did it. And I'm still here. And nothing adverse has happened. And I use this analogy about Peter in the boat. And he asked Jesus, can I come? And Jesus said, get out the boat. And Peter was the only one to get out the boat to come to Jesus. But then doubt came across him and he began to drown. But I tell the people I talk to, I'm getting out the boat. I'm getting out the boat.
Letty got out of the boat. She got her shot. the majority of Americans are facing this very same choice for the first time as vaccines become available to everyone. In this series, we've shown how mistrust and misinformation conspire to make people hesitant, and how some people are working to solve that problem. On the series finale of Doubt, we'll take a look at where things stand, and if enough people are getting vaccinated so that we can finally go back to normal. Doubt is written and reported by me, Kristen V. Brown. Topher Forges is our senior producer. Molly Nugent is our associate producer. Our theme was composed and performed by Hannes Brown. Special thanks to Bloomberg editors Tim Annette and Rick Schein. Francesca Levy is the head of Bloomberg Podcasts. Be sure to subscribe to Prognosis if you haven't already. And if you like our show, please leave us a review. It helps others find out about the show. Thanks for listening. See you next time.
It can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
The countdown has begun. From May 14th to 16th, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections, gain unique insights, and uncover valuable opportunities in one of the world's most rapidly rising regions. Request your invite for this exclusive event at QatarEconomicForum.com.